You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Eisenhower was 12 years old when President Dwight D. Eisenhower, his grandfather, left the White House after two terms and retired to live on a Pennsylvania farm with his extended family. Now, David, in collaboration with his wife, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, has recounted those years in a new book called Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings David and Julie Eisenhower to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning, Leonard.
Julie, Ike was David's grandfather. What made you decide to work on this book together?
Well, David and I have written books before, and we always worked together, but we never had a formal, with credit. But on this one, I guess Dave was just very generous and said, Julie, you've really helped me be the closer. He calls me the Mariana Rivera of the book, making sure that it got done. And so I'm
Julie,
he's the author and I'm with.
Julie's written two books and I know that I helped her with these projects, but she could have done them on her own. And I know that I could have done the Eisenhower War book on World War II in the final analysis on my own. But this is a book that I could not have completed without Julie because of her, her editorial skills, but above all, her sense for the completeness of a story.
So you weren't doing research or anything. You were just saying, hey, maybe this story could be told a little differently.
Also, just helping him decide there was so much to tell. What stories?
Well, see, this is a story that's really
close
to my heart, so I could carry on and on and on. I could have written a book four or five times longer. Or shorter, depending. And so I started relying on Julie's sense of what was enough, and that was vital. The book could not have been completed, would have never come out, I don't think, without her.
Well, it's good to see a couple working together like this. You've known each other since you were children. Some people might say enough.
Well, we met at the 1957 inauguration of Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, and it was a very brief meeting, though there is a picture of me looking at Dave and Dave looking at me. But we really didn't see each other. 8 years old. Didn't see each other till we were freshmen in college. And that's when Mamie Eisenhower played matchmaker. And she kept saying to David, you've got to look up Julie Nixon. She's a really nice girl.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
she'd actually met Julie encountered her at a funeral, I think, about 3 weeks before we arrive in college, about 7 miles apart. And so Mamie was the first to see Julie as a teenager, and her report was very encouraging. So I guess
I improved from age 8.
Yeah.
Your grandfather left office 50 years ago.
Exactly 50.
And what made you decide to write this book now?
I think the basic decision is that we're not getting younger, and the time has come to realize many decades, in fact, since Eisenhower at War came out, since Pat Nixon came out, we have spent a good deal of time developing manuscripts and ideas. We have the time has come to realize these projects, and this is the one I wanted to be sure of. While we were out and around, I want to be completely sure that this book, which means so much to me and to Julie, that we would make sure that this comes out, and then we proceed from here to other projects.
You alternate in the book between calling him grandfather and Eisenhower.
Right. Well, I think that's actually a well-established habit by now because I've been teaching at the University of Pennsylvania for a long time, and I teach, I would say, recent history. I teach communications, presidential speeches, and in that class, this man is Eisenhower. I use the name Eisenhower throughout Eisenhower at War. 850 pages in Eisenhower at War. I do not use the word I once, and I use Eisenhower throughout. So he is Eisenhower. That's one side of this. But he's granddad in this wonderful relationship that I will never forget that I recreate in this book.
Well,
he's also Leonard General.
He's General, yeah.
Well,
he's,
that's a third. And that's interesting because after he left the White House, didn't he request that he have his five-star
yes.
general return to him?
He did, and I described this in the book, and this is a request made of President Kennedy. The entire episode is described for me by Ted Clifton, who is Kennedy's military aide. It puzzled Kennedy. He didn't know what taking the title of general meant. Why not president Eisenhower?
Most people would prefer to be President Eisenhower.
Well, I think what Dwight Eisenhower was saying is that, the most profound bond he had in his ultimate obligation in public service was to the GI who fought in Europe, and that his presidency was an extension of the war in Europe. We won the war in 1944 and 45, and his presidency was an attempt, and a successful one, to win the peace in Europe that followed.
Where was the farm that your grandfather retired to? I said Pennsylvania, but it's a big state.
It's Gettysburg. Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, right across the border, just across the Mason-Dixon line, heading due north from Washington. Scene of the Great Battle, scene of the Gettysburg Address, the most famous American speech in history. And I think these things associated with this wonderful town, Gettysburg, and the college, are what drew Dwight Eisenhower to the area. He wanted to retire, it seems to me, in a location that was pleasant and inspiring.
Because he could have gone to Kansas.
He could have gone to Kansas. He could have spent his entire retirement, I think, in rotating between Augusta, Georgia, and Palm Desert.
Because that's where the golf
That's where the golf was. That's where his friends were. But he, his project after leaving the White House, and it was underway by the time he did leave the White House, was to leave a piece of ground in southern Pennsylvania better than he found it. And that was to take a 190-acre homestead and turn this into a working farm. 50 years later, 40 years after he's passed away, the Eisenhower Farm is now a National Historic Site, but it is also leased out and farmed. It is a beautiful, flourishing farm just south of the town of Gettysburg.
And you lived there, and there was an extended family.
There was an extended family. We were actually a very small family, and that's why this story is compact and I think worth telling. I think we're very special.
Well, grandparents. Your father had been his aide, so there was another kind of connection there.
And he was his only son. And so you have Ike and Mamie, and then you have my dad, their only son, his wife, my mother, Barbara, and then the four of us, and just the eight lived right there on the farm.
My guests are David Eisenhower and Julie Nixon Eisenhower. The book Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Julie, throughout our history, most vice presidents were given little to do. What about your father? Was he frustrated by the limitations of the job?
Well, Leonard, Eisenhower actually gave his vice president a great deal to do. He's the first president to do so. He sent my father and mother to 53 nations around the world, including Vietnam, all through Africa, Latin America, Russia, Europe.
You go on any of those trips?
No, because I was just in grade school. He also had him preside over cabinet meetings when he wasn't able to be there. He settled the steel strike. He included him in diplomatic efforts. And my father was eternally grateful. You know, there was a great deal of hero worship on my father's part for Eisenhower for many reasons. He was a mentor. He was a father figure. But also, he made the vice presidency a real job. Because it was what's the famous saying that it's no worse than a warm bowl of spit or something?
Right.
But the Eisenhower, I think, proved that he was a big man because he basically shared power.
Because he accepted it. And the other thing, and Julie, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is that I can't remember the last vice president that hasn't been called the most important vice president in American history. Recalling it. In fact, Nixon is by far the most important vice president in American history. He is His vice presidency establishes the vice president as the heir to the president. Julie mentioned power sharing. That's exactly what happened. Richard Nixon has to be the most powerful vice president. He had greater standing in the Republican Party than Eisenhower did. He is a vital connection between the Eisenhower presidency and the Republican Party. He can't govern without the Republican Party. He's by 1960, he's The heir apparent, he's the first vice president in history to be seen that way, and that is a groundbreaking vice presidency, and there has not been one as powerful since, in my opinion.
You know, also along that theme, it's interesting because people had loved Ike. We like Ike. But they didn't know if he was a Republican or a Democrat. Right. And one thing I really love in the book is the diaries that from Truman and Eisenhower, where they talk about Truman offering to run as Eisenhower's vice president in 1948 because Truman was so determined to keep MacArthur off the Republican ticket. So Truman is assuming Eisenhower is a Democrat, right? But Eisenhower turned out to be a Republican.
Well, you know,
but he was a liberal Republican, an almost extinct species today.
Well, he was what I would call a moderate Republican, not a liberal. Moderate Republican is someone, in fact, he's a very conservative man. But moderate Republican is somebody that a moderate anything. Is somebody who really enjoys people and assumes the best of people on both sides of the aisle and works hard for sort of a meeting of the mind and consensus. It refers to sort of style and temperament, and Dwight Eisenhower had a great political temperament. Len Hall, former chairman of the Republican National Committee for years, decades in national service, told me that the two greatest natural politicians he saw in his entire lifetime, 50 years, were Al Smith and Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower is somebody who liked people and was a great natural politician.
Although he did have, at the time, people made fun of his communication skills because he didn't give the best press conferences of any of the presidents in our history. He wasn't the worst, but he did seem to be rather uncomfortable.
Well, his press conferences are not what I would call very tight because they were not given for live broadcast. If you are going to be on the air in live broadcast, you arrive with a script, and you'll have questions prepared. You'll have people in the press corps who are going to volunteer questions. So it's going to be a much tighter performance. The transcripts of the Eisenhower press conferences exist, and they are interesting, and they are highly informative, and they also tend to ramble a little bit, but they're also not live broadcast. These are conversations around a coffee table.
One other thing, Leonard, after his 57 stroke, he really groped for words. You know, he made a full recovery, but he never again was comfortable giving a speech and or giving a press conference. He thought he was fearful that there would be a word he couldn't access.
Now, did he expect to be consulted the way Hoover had been earlier? I know that he
I think he expected to assume an even greater role. But now Hoover actually chaired commissions, but Dwight Eisenhower had an altogether different relationship with Kennedy, but especially Johnson, successor. See, the thing is,
well, he was consulted on the Bay of Pigs. In fact, they went to Camp David, which was named after you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. In fact, the interesting thing that happens is that Kennedy and Eisenhower are very wary of one another, I think, when Kennedy first takes office. But then what developed in 1962 and into early 1963 was a very cordial relationship. President Kennedy consults Eisenhower on Cuba. He consults him on the Nassau meetings with Macmillan in great depth. He consults him on arms control and other things. But the relationship between Eisenhower and Johnson goes well beyond formal consultation or solicitation of views. They are friends, and they've been friends since the late 1950s, and they were in pretty continual contact throughout the 65 through 68 period. And it's an extraordinary relationship between two former presidents. The thing is, Eisenhower is the first president in American history to serve, to be term limited by the 22nd Amendment. He is undefeated nationally. He's only run for two elections in his life, presidency and elected overwhelmingly both times. Somebody with a record like that never really ceases being a president in some sense. And so he had a great deal of, popularity and stature in the country. And that reason alone meant that his Democratic successors felt they had to consult him. But in the case of Lyndon Johnson, it was a definite friendship.
My guests are David Eisenhower, who's skipped a few years in the follow-up from his best-selling book, Eisenhower at War, 1943-1945, We're now in 1961 through 1969 in Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, written with the help of Julie Nixon Eisenhower and published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Dwight D. Eisenhower speaking right before he left office on January 12, 1961, perhaps his most famous speech, and one that still resonates today. We're talking with David Eisenhower, who has written a memoir of life with his grandfather, 1961-1969, called Going Home to Glory. Also with us is Julie Nixon Eisenhower, who collaborated on the book, which is published by Simon & Schuster. And I wonder, David, what you think your grandfather would make of the current situation. Mm-hmm. Isn't the military-industrial complex one of the few areas where we're unlikely to see many cuts as part of the deficit reduction?
Well, I'm not sure that cuts would have mattered. The key point made of that speech now 50 years ago, and you're right, it was a great speech. It is the greatest farewell address in American history.
George Washington's farewell address.
Washington's address was not an address, so let's call this an address. It was a letter. It is a that's right. These are two classical statements separated by centuries and so on. But
and two generals.
Not, yeah, it was not that's about right. the size of military expenditures, his farewell warning. It was about control over it. Is the Congress exerting critical control over Pentagon budget? Are Democratic checks, in fact, in place? I think that they were in his period. He was trying to strengthen them, but I think he was drawing attention to a problem the military-industrial complex, and he ran through a litany of other complexes as well, anything that had this symbiotic relationship with government expenditures and so forth, would essentially become autonomous, evade popular controls. This is a call for Americans to be citizens in 1961, not to be intimidated by the claims of experts, not to yield control over their lives to a military-industrial complex or any complex, that is, take charge. It's based on his analysis of what went wrong in Europe and around the world, the great tragedies of the 20th century. People ceased to be citizens, and so his parting comment is, be a citizen.
Well, he was a general, and yet he ended the Korean War, although North Korea has just broken that treaty again. Mm-hmm. What do you think his feelings would be about the role of the U.S. military in situations like Afghanistan or Iraq, or of his own party's resistance today to agreeing to an updated SALT treaty?
Well, I think the one thing that would have amazed everybody in that era is the routine nature of American deployments overseas. I think that in the Eisenhower years, a deployment overseas was considered to be an extraordinary thing. And so we go to war. We go to war to win. And we go to war, as Eisenhower says to British cadets at Sandhurst 4 weeks before D-Day, in order to get this over with as quickly as possible and go home. Today we are, involved in 120 countries. American forces are deployed everywhere. And this doesn't seem to bother anybody. This would have surprised everybody from the Eisenhower years 50 years ago. We have willy-nilly taken on military aid missions everywhere around the world and major garrisons in many places. And this has not been particularly examined. One reason it hasn't been examined is that we have an all-volunteer army. And an all-volunteer army is a chess, this is an institution that the president can move without fear of arousing a great deal of popular resistance. That has had the effect of removing, to a great extent, it seems to me, public interest and control over military deployments. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Well, Julie, it's interesting that the period covered in this book is a period between the Eisenhower leaving the White House and pretty much your father becoming president.
Exactly.
And there was a lot of change in the 60s, but nothing like what we've seen since.
Right.
The presidents were not dealing with WikiLeaks, for example. What do you see as the political landscape changing since Eisenhower left office? Do you see this as all negative?
I don't see it as all negative, but I do think that the whole security explosion, which I call it a security explosion, because Eisenhower left office on Inauguration Day, January 1961, in his 1955 Chrysler Imperial that Mamie bought him for his 65th birthday. He goes back to Gettysburg with one escort of Secret Service who honk the horn and make a U-turn and go back to Washington. Today, the president is encased in the White House. We don't have whistle-stop train campaigning as we did even in 68. We don't have the motorcades.
Kennedy, the assassination, took care of the motorcades.
Right. That really changed everything. Former presidents then had security. It's just, and the other thing that's changed so dramatically from the Eisenhower leaving office to my father coming in is the rise of the role of television. And today with the internet, everything is online.
Now, what about your father? After they left the White House, he lost his race against John F. Kennedy. Then he ran for governor in 1962. Had he been anxious to remain in politics?
No, actually, one thing that we talk about in the book is how Eisenhower really leaned on him to run in California, said it was his duty. He didn't want to run because, as he said, I'm not interested in being governor. I'm interested in world affairs. But anyway, he ran. He lost badly.
He made that famous speech.
Yeah,
you won't have
right.
Dick Nixon to kick around anymore.
Right.
You know, so was he very – he obviously was very bitter at the time.
I think he was very upset. Of course, my mother's sitting there with Tricia and me and listening to it. She got up and she cheered, yay!
Leonard, we're sitting here in New York. And we spent the 1968 campaign in New York. In fact, we were part of the campaign operation. We were being sent around the country. Julie and I were engaged at the time. And I can remember being told by my father that when Richard Nixon runs, they will haul out the transcripts and the pictures of Nixon's last press conference, and that campaign will never get off the ground. That never happened.
It's a
very good thing. The Democrats actually reviewed it. This is covered in a couple of books. The ad agency that was handling Humphrey reviewed this very, very carefully, and they said, we don't dare touch this. This could help him. saying to Nixon, don't run in politics, is like saying to it's like saying to Mark Teixeira, don't play first base for the Yankees. You know, the thing is, he just had this great ability, and he was going to run again after 1960. What he earned in 1960 by basically tying Kennedy was a second chance. And he that was going to happen someday. He did not want to run in 62 because I think his instinct told him that things could go wrong in California, that somebody else might be a better candidate. My grandfather pushed him into that race in a big way, and he went along with it.
And many people assume that that was the end of his political career. You lose – it's one thing to lose a presidential election. You can always win the next time.
But
winning a gubernatorial election after that
– wasn't anywhere near the end of his career. And the reason is he's one of the most durable figures in American history because of the incredibly intense identification of middle-class voters with Nixon in the 1950s. It was a phenomenon.
In 1992, a couple people sent me buttons that said – a picture of my dad, and it said, he's tan, he's rested, he's ready. what can we say?
Now, that's a good campaign slogan.
Right.
Yeah, well, this is, they kept, every time he appeared in any big way, people would notice that. It's just, he had extraordinary energy. Richard Nixon, unlike Dwight Eisenhower, is somebody who made an appearance on the national scene at a relatively young age. Dwight Eisenhower did not become a national and international figure until his mid-50s. Richard Nixon was a national figure by the time he's 39 years old. And so he was a young phenom.
My guests are David Eisenhower and Julie Nixon. Eisenhower, we're talking about Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961-1969, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The title, what is the significance of the title?
The significance is that there is a gravestone in Elizabethville, Pennsylvania, where it has the words to the hymn, I'm Going Home to Glory. It's an Eisenhower gravestone, and it's Eisenhower's journey and his acceptance of his death and his buoyancy and positive outlook about the future.
Yeah, Leonard, something that happens in the book, I think the most important part of it, national politics and political affairs is something that my grandfather does. And so we cover it in this book. But the real story is our small family in southern Pennsylvania together on this farm, which was an idyllic place. And in the time frame covered by this book, my grandfather grows old and I grow up. I am almost 13 when he returns from Washington to become a farmer on the wintry night of January 20th, 1961, and he dies on March 28th, and his funeral is my 21st birthday. So,
did he talk about politics and what had gone on? Because, you know, he had had an eventful presidency, not just
he didn't talk about his presidency.
Ever? He didn't talk about having to deal with McCarthy and some of the other
things? In fact, I didn't even know who McCarthy was until I arrived in Amherst in the fall of 1966. I was not raised in a political atmosphere. Julie was. One of the things that really interested me in meeting Julie in the fall of 1966 is that she knew it is really sort of an introduction to me to this world of campaigning and so on. All that was in the past when I knew my grandfather, and it would come up from time to time. The war was in the past, too. Everything that was in the past did not come up much.
We found an interesting clip from a little earlier, 1953, that might surprise a lot of listeners and may surprise you as well. I doubt that it'll surprise you, but it is really interesting to hear this.
Don't join the book burners. Don't think you're going to conceal faults by concealing evidence that they ever existed. Don't be afraid to go in your library and read every book, as long as any document does not offend our own ideas and of decency. That should be the only censorship.
That's Dartmouth College.
Yeah.
Well, commencement, 1953.
And this at a time when McCarthy
was at his height.
Yeah.
Out of control.
Well, McCarthy is, this is something that I've come to understand since, because we have huge drafts on the Eisenhower presidency, which will probably develop into books. And McCarthy is a huge obstacle to Eisenhower's ability to govern. Mm-hmm. He's an obstacle to Eisenhower's effort to point the Republican Party towards the future. McCarthy is about one thing. And that is recriminations in America over a sense that people got hurt in World War II for no reason. The McCarthy idea is that America is all-powerful, and yet America compromised with the Soviet Union and Europe, and meaning that our leadership is either stupid or communist. And we had to get beyond this argument. Politics has stalled on it. We had to get beyond it if the Republican Party was going to become a governing party in this country.
Well, when people are surprised by some of the things that are said about current politicians, I think back to the John Birch Society claiming that your grandfather was a dupe of the communists or was in the pay of the communists. I can't remember.
I think you're right. I think
absolutely. That's why my father lost to California in '62. The John Birch Society candidate was named Joe Shell, and so the Republicans in the Birch Society sat out the election.
Yeah, I don't think that we don't have a label in politics today that compares with the label pro-communist in the late 40s. Pro-communism in the late 40s meant the end of your livelihood, meant banishment. It was a very serious problem facing the country, and it was caused. My grandfather has some very interesting meditations on this. I think it was caused by an air of anxiety, which is very difficult to recreate today. But
we do have the feeling about anti-terrorists.
No, but 5 years, 1950, when McCarthy erupts, this is 5 years after the A-bomb. Mm-hmm. The A-bomb is the advent of an entirely new era in history. And we don't know where the obliteration could be around the corner tomorrow. Western civilization is getting used to this idea, and fears all took on were greatly magnified by that fact and by the horrors of World War II, which were as close to those people in 1950 as George Bush versus John Kerry is to us, if you think of it. This is they are very close in on the advent of the atomic age and on the discovery of just what a horrible war World War II had been.
Now, you were a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for your previous book, Eisenhower at War. That was a work of real history. This is more of a memoir.
Right.
An awful lot has been written about these times. Are there things that you can write about that we haven't heard yet?
Well, I think that what an historian can do, and I'm reading a great book right now, in fact, by an historian who, as far as I can see, really does not present new information, but presents information that exists in a fascinating way that involves you in it. I think that's what an historian does.
You're talking about Edmund Morris's Teddy Roosevelt?
I'm talking about Talmadge Boston, who's not a writer well known. But having said that, we actually break more new material in Going Home to Glory than I broke in 900 pages on World War II. The diaries that we tap in this book are brand new. The correspondence between me and my grandfather, no one knew existed. Documents, the minutes of the various meetings that my grandfather had, meeting as a former president in his Gettysburg office and so forth, have never been utilized. The entire book is based on unpublished primary sources, which nobody knew about. So as far as presenting new information, this book is altogether different than the war book. As far as presenting a new interpretation, I think the war book is probably the most important thing I'll ever do.
Sure.
Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
Julie Nixon Eisenhower, David Eisenhower, their book, Going Home to Glory, A Memoir of Life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961-1969, published by Simon & Schuster.
Leonard, thanks for having us.